Hello and welcome back to the How the Race Was Won podcast. I'm Dan Cash, and it is post-Flanders. We are here to talk about how the Tour of Flanders was won, which is a pretty special thing to talk about because it's just such a special bike race. And I just cannot wait to get into it with bike racing analyst extraordinaire, Cosmo Catalano. Cosmo, how are you?
I am well. How are you, Dan? Maybe you should specify for the listening audience when you say we are here. Where is it that you are?
Yeah, I'm farther away from you than normal right now.
Well, unless you're the UK audience. But
I'm farther away from you, Cosmo, than normal right now.
Gotcha.
Normally, we are a mere, I don't know, what, 1,000 miles apart?
It's about two, I think, from Boston to Front Range.
And currently, we're farther than that, as I am in Ghent, Belgium, here with the Escape crew covering the classics. Spent the day at the Tour of Flanders, and it was quite a day, quite a wet day at the Tour of Flanders. It was a day that made it really great to have, you know, a roof over my head as I watched these sad riders slip and slide their way up and over the Koppenberg. And it was, quite an experience to watch and to see them come to the finish line more beat, more wiped out than I can remember seeing them at this race. It was quite a challenging day for them today. So we are going to talk about how the Tour of Flanders was won. We're going to talk about how Mathieu van der Poel did the thing. He was the pre-race favorite. And a heavy pre-race favorite. And that is rare in a one-day race. And he went on to win the race quite handily. He did the thing. He did it from farther out than even I expected, than I think many would have expected. That was quite far out for this race. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the Koppenberg, which was muddy and slick and decisive in a way that it has not been since I have watched. And we're going to talk about how or whether anyone could have reasonably tacticsed their way to actually challenging van der Poel, which I don't know if they could have, but
people tried. People tried.
They tried. Did they try what they should have tried? Maybe they left things on the table. I'm going to ask bike racing analyst Cosmo Catalano to provide us with his takes on this subject. But first, before I do any of that, just real quickly, let me say that we are loving doing this podcast, and we've got a great season ahead, and we can do all of these things because of the support of our members. So if you're not a member, head on over to escapecollective.com/join and become one. And if you are a member, well, we're very grateful. So thank you. All right. The Tour of Flanders 2024, the men's race. What's the headline, Cosmo Catalano?
Mathieu van der Poel, strongest man in race. Alpecin team supporting him, biggest surprise. That's how I kind of characterize it.
That is good headline style.
No, it's like, I went for like a 30s kind of like newsprint kind of thing.
Yeah, no need for
destroys.
Linking verbs. No need for
unreal
articles. Yeah, well done. You're hired at the paper owned by William Randolph Hearst. what did you see?
I saw Visma Lisa Bike and Lidl Trek really try to take the race to van der Poel early, very similar to what we saw work at Gent-Wevelgem and not quite work at Etre. A lot of really early moves by really strong riders. Both Matteo Jorgensen, who is sort of the default guy for Visma in Wout's absence, and Mats Pedersen, who's been the default guy for Lidl Trek all spring. The only difference was that Mathieu van der Poel did not take the bait. The closest he came to the front of the race for the first, until basically 40K to go, was both Pedersen and Jorgensen got clear. And he's like, okay, if you're both going clear, I'm going to follow you. And other than that, pretty much everything, you know, Jorgensen made a big attack around 110K out, and they actually had a great camera shot from the chopper of it. Van der Poel in the middle of the group, kind of like moving up a wheel, and then behind Jorgensen, two Alpecin riders. And then Mess Pedersen goes again, and you could kind of see, you could see Vanderpool's head in the back, and it just no attempt to get up there. Nothing, not going to get drawn into what he got drawn into at Gent-Wevelgem. And his team really stepped up. Like, a very big group went clear at around 96K to go. That was like a lot of strong guys. Benoit was there. Paulet was there. Definitely a potential, like, could win the race from this far out move. And Albasson just put Vermeersch across in it, and he hung out there. And, you know, Albasson let UAE do some chasing, some other teams chase, and then whipped up the pace. And Vanderpool kind of bridged across in the Barren Dries. They repeated, as soon as Vanderpool got there, Pedersen tried to go it again. And instead of Vanderpool, what you ended up with was Vermeersch chasing him again, or really actually just sitting on his wheel, occasionally taking a pull so he didn't, you know, get mad and try to drop him. And then again, Albasson whipped it up coming into the Eau de Clermont at around like 56K to go. And Vanderpool attacked, but really more bridged, just kind of bridged up to the group. I think very purposefully rode past Pedersen and Vermeersch, kind of kept the pedal on over the top of the Clermont, but then eased off in that section where everything regroups. Ivan Garcia Cortina from Movistar thought this was a great spot to get away, which I agree with, a kind of very disordered group. And he had Lescano back in the group, his teammate. And then he came into the Koppenberg and immediately lost his rear wheel. Like, basically, as soon as he started pedaling in, you know, a reasonably low gear for that kind of pitch, it was so wet and sloppy, just immediately slid out. Apparently, according to Dane, he got off the bike to let air out of the rear tire and then attempted to remount and ride back up the hill. By that point, Vanderpool, if he hadn't attacked, had already kind of distanced the front of the group, turned up the pace. Only Jorgensen and Pedersen were even near him, but already the gap was kind of there. They all, you know, there was a kind of a pinch point around Garcia Cortina, and a lot of people got off. I think pretty much everybody further than fourth or fifth down had to hike a little bit. And yeah,
in road shoes.
Yeah. I mean, in road shoes on slippery ground, slippery to ride, basically.
I said this to Kaylee as we're watching, I'm thinking like the real tech hack for this race is to just like rock the mountain bike shoes.
I'm a little surprised that we haven't seen more of that, especially watching in the women's race, Capecchi running in the road shoes.
Like, his response was, of course, to just be a mountain biker like Vanderpool and therefore not have to dismount because you're good enough, which, okay, sure.
Even Vanderpool had some like big fishtails when he was really laying the power down.
Yeah.
But yeah, he came over the top maybe 7-8 seconds in front of Jorgensen. And we saw a little bit of a mini Etre repeat where he's kind of within 10 seconds. You're like, oh, maybe he can bridge. And the next climb, the floodgates just open, you know, from 10 seconds to 20 seconds. And then a minute, and Vanderpool himself said he was pretty empty coming into the line. And I think just everybody was. I think people went for it. They rode hard, and, you know, they left it all out in the road. And basically everybody who tried anything early in the race before 50K to go was pretty wrecked at the finish. And you ended up basically with a group sprint for second, taken by Mazzato, and briefly third to Michael Matthews before he got relegated, which maybe he shouldn't have. I think there's some discussion points there. Yeah, Niels Paulet,
lots of discussion
came in as the
points. Niels Paulet was the one who ended up there. Lots of discussion points that you've raised here. Let's start with me eating crow. That's the segment. I have to say, I'm sorry, Alpecin. I did not expect your team depth to be able to do what it is you did in this race. And that is even with me thinking that Jasper Philipsen was going to be at the Tour of Flanders, which he was not. The team decided not to send him to the Tour of Flanders. And yet, Johnny Vermeersch, not by himself, but certainly he was the real driving force here, had a really big impact in Mathieu van der Poel being well-positioned to do what he did in the end. I'm not entirely convinced that he couldn't have just like done it anyway, but he didn't have to work harder than he did at various points because of the way that Vermeersch rode.
And it's all team.
And he trusted in his teammates. And that's another thing that you got to give credit to him for, because he knew that his teammates, well, he knew that Vermeersch in particular was going to be able to do what he did and go with the right moves, follow the right moves. And that meant, as you pointed out, there were some times when Vanderpool didn't have to work extra hard when maybe a less confident in their teammates Ryder might have. I mean, you see Ryder's go with moves that they maybe don't need to go with relatively frequently in bike racing, and it's precious energy saved when you don't have to do that. Yeah, so I got to give credit to Vermeersch for really being a great teammate on this day, and I'll have that humble pie and that crow gladly.
Will you have it enough to call them Albertsen de Kooning, or will you still just say Albertsen?
Yeah. Yes, Albertsen de Kooning. Yep. You've earned the full sponsor name this one time. Yeah. Whereas Visma, I don't know. Have you earned it? I know you're asking for it. I know you want us to give you your full sponsor name.
They have a whole social media campaign.
Oh, I'm well aware.
Are losing, you know, Dane. Dane Cash is losing that competition by not saying Visma Lisa Bike.
I mean, they're losing the competition by having too long of a damn name. I don't know. They actually did earn it. Matteo Jorgensen earned it. He worked really hard today. We'll get to that in a bit. But yeah, Albertsen had an all around a good race, obviously spearheaded by Mathieu van der Poel. So to me, the big question in general, coming out of you telling us how this race is won, is what could the rivals of Mathieu van der Poel have done? Rivals that did not include Wout van Aert, obviously. What could Peterson have done? What could Matteo Jorgensen have done? What could the riders who really wanted to beat Mathieu van der Poel today and didn't, what could they have done? Could they have done anything? What at least would have been their best chance of taking this race to van der Poel? And I wanted to ask that question and then also posit a potential answer. So Ronan McLaughlin, who was at the race with the crew today, suggested, I think he said this in the placeholders in Oudenaarde right after the race. I was sitting next to the placeholders when they were recording, but I had one ear listening to that, but then I was also like writing about something for the website. So I think he said this, I think he brought this up, which is that if the other teams had wanted to really race for the win and not race for second, then they might have gone with Peterson when Peterson tried a move that, in hindsight, and he actually came out and said this, I'll get to that in a second, looked kind of futile. But it was a moment where Vanderpool might have been vulnerable because he had just bridged and put in an effort and had expended energy. Does that mean that he's going to lose? I don't know. But it does seem like Ronan had a good point, which is when Peterson went, that might have been a time where others could have gone with him. And that might have been the best time, because it was at least a moment in which Vanderpool had expended energy and did suddenly look a little bit like, okay, he might actually not be, you know, world beating in this moment. He became world beating. He got back to his best very quickly. Anyway, I don't know. What is your take on that? What do you think?
I was a little surprised that more people didn't go with Peterson. I think it maybe betrayed their lack of faith in this in this early racing strategy, that the fact that the only person that went with him was one of Vanderpool's teammates, was someone riding defensively. Because you had Pollitt in that group. You had Benoit, who was in the chase group until he had a mechanical and they gave him the wrong bike. Throwback to the...
Which is something we've seen before from that team. This one was pretty egregious because it's hard to get this bike wrong. There's a big flag on it.
Yep. Well, it's only on the fork, so... You never know. And I think at, was it Roubaix? It was Roubaix, where the actual Roubaix, not Tour de France Roubaix, where they had briefly had Van Aert on the Dutch national champions bike, because I think they're about, it was not Van Barlet. I think it was someone else at that point in time. But I remember like that was his specific, like, that was the guy who would ride with him to take the bike if a mechanical happened. I think one happened on the Arenberg, and he ended up on the Dutch champion bike, I think, while wearing the Belgian champion jersey. I could be just misremembering, because that's really funny. But yeah, this is...
That would have been good, yeah.
Yeah, but I know, it was clear. I mean, as soon as Benoit got the bike, he was like, no, this is not the right
bike. Yeah, it was pretty clear. He did not want to try.
Yeah.
Nope, wrong bike.
Going back, okay. Yeah, so you had Benoit, you had Pollitt, you had a lot of strong riders, and nobody went with Peterson. I think, actually, as evidenced by Paulette's third place, that it turned out to be the right decision, but not the right decision if people were trying to beat Vanderpool.
Right.
I think if there were some way, somehow, that people could have managed to get Vanderpool out of the group, to get him up the road the way he went up the road against Wevelgem, I think it would have been possible today for the wheels to completely come off. Because number one, he himself said, even from like 20K out, like coming at the last time at the Paderberg, he was feeling really empty. He was worried a little bit. He was going to cramp, I think he said. He definitely extended his left leg and reached down to his hamstring a little bit and rubbed it. He's still a minute and a half up the road, so it's not a big issue. But this is also someone who has had these big days where he goes, he just, you know, does the super powerful superhero attack and then runs out of steam. You know, it happened at Tirreno Adriatico, I think, a few years ago. He is definitely the same way he rides a bike, I think, is the way he feeds. And he's just going to go for it. And if he crashes his bike or if he doesn't have enough energy in his stomach, that happens. But you know what? He went for it. And so I think that if Vanderpool is beatable today, you've got to figure out some way to get him out of the group early and then have somebody in the group who is just totally chilled out, relaxed. I think after a certain point with Pedersen's attack where it became clear that he was hung out to dry, I was thinking maybe Lidl Trek was trying to pull that with Jonathan Milan. But, you know, he was already a couple groups back. It's such a hard race, I think, being a big dude like he is. I think that is really get Vanderpool to waste energy and get beat up by the weather and then have somebody waiting in the end to kind of sneak away with the race. But I agree mostly that he pretty much unbeatable riding the way he did and riding the way his team did today.
I do think that you pointed out there was a lack of faith in the chances of that distance, of the attack at that distance. And I want to kind of contrast the two mindsets of Vanderpool in this race and everyone else, which is the same thing as Tadej Pogacar in many of his races and everyone else. And it's a mindset where the Vanderpool or Pogacar, depending on the race, in their mind, they're capable of going from what seems like an absurd distance to the rest of us mortals. And they are confident enough in their chances that they'll do it. And the rest of the field, on the other hand, doesn't think that that's possible for them, and therefore they don't try it. Mm. And that might be true, that it's not possible for them. That could very well be true. But it also, I think, in this instance and many of the times, it's their best chance to try to anticipate and go farther, which it's like, maybe it's a doomed attack, but at least it's the best chance, I would think. And so, as you pointed out, for Paulette, what he did got him onto the podium. And if that's your goal, understandable. But if you are Visma, I think Visma was trying to win this race. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that Matteo Jorgensen buried himself trying to chase down Pogacar to the point where
Vanderpool,
with 30K to go, maybe, I don't know the exact number, he looked to me like, oh, he's clearly going to come in second. And then 5 minutes later, he was clearly not going to finish the top 10.
Yeah.
Because he was going all in trying to catch Vanderpool rather than not and just settling for second or third. So I think Visma wanted to win this race. They were willing to burn matches. They were willing to send Jorgensen, willing to play that way, you know, play that tactic with Jorgensen. And so I wonder if maybe the better tactic would have been to try to go farther out, send Tish Benoit, send someone. And they did try a little bit. Jorgensen himself did some, you know, attacking. Obviously easier said than done. It's not easy to drop the whole Tour of Flanders field and also Mathieu van der Poel as well. But I do think that might have been, you know, that when Pedersen went, maybe you try to go with him in that time. And again, does it work? I don't know. I honestly doubt it. But if you really want to try to win, that might be your best bet. We'll never know. But I do know that it seemed like there was that brief moment of vulnerability.
You said that Jorgensen went all in to chase down Pogacar, not Vanderpool.
I want to, you know, like we could edit in post, but it's that, like, I think that mistake is worth leaving because, you know, it's like the way that Pogacar rode Strade and the way that, you know, he rides a lot of races and the way we've talked about with Vanderpool. I mean, there's a similarity there that I think, yeah, it's, there's a reason there to get confused, I think. And I think that the strategies of a lot of the other teams have to evolve because these attacks are coming from farther and farther and farther out to the point where what do we do if we're the other riders?
I don't know that the big attack, the race winning attack came in about the same spot it came at Etre, right? It came, Etre was up the Paterberg at 40 something, 42, 43. And this was over the Koppenberg at 45-ish, 44. I mean, again, they're very different races. Flanders is a lot longer. There's a lot more hills. Yes. So that 40K, especially with today's weather, that 45K is a long 45K. But as the crow flies, it is not from Santa Maria to the finish at Strade. But as we talked about, what?
The Koppenberg, though, at Flanders, it's not. It's different in that you then have to go over the Steen victories, the Tyenberg, the Kreuzberg.
You got to do lots more stuff. I was just saying, in terms of like pure distance, not thinking
pure
about,
distance. Yeah, true. In any case, they do both of them continue to push the envelope in terms of long range attacks, and it's something that the Peloton's got to get wise to it. That said, I think credit to Jorgensen for riding the way that he did and not trying, not just pulling the pin on the chase right away. I thought that was the kind of riding that people often complain is not done. And he did try. So good on you, Matteo Jorgensen, even if you were the second favorite and you finished 31st, you rode in a way that, so we're doing the run sheet here and I'm thinking he, results wise, if you just go to PCS after the race, if you didn't see the race, you're gonna think, man, Matteo Jorgensen was really overhyped heading in. But if you watch the race, I think you know that Matteo Jorgensen came closer than anybody to latching on to Vanderpool, who almost certainly would have then dropped him in the end anyway. But it was an effort that I think was all or nothing, and it turned out nothing. Well, 31st, not nothing, but it's something you kind of had to watch the race to know that he was more involved in the finale than it looks. And yet, Vanderpool, clear winner. Very, very, very clear winner. More than a minute. He's really, really starting to take a liking to the old stopping and picking up his bike celebration. And he keeps getting enough time to do it. Let's take a quick break. Let's talk Koppenberg. We have suggested that the Koppenberg was really, really, really messy, and it was obviously a decisive moment in the race. I think we should point out that you can't really overstate how big of a deal the Koppenberg was this year, how much of a challenge it was. I have not seen the Koppenberg like this in my time watching the sport. I've seen old photos of it being a walk up it kind of climb. But since I have been covering the bike racing, it's not something that we've seen this much, this many people having to get off the bike. Yeah. And I mean, it was really wild.
I was cooking up a hot take in my head when I was watching the race about how the only reason they took this climb out of the race is because people got stupid about road bikes and they decided that, you know, they had basically given up on reasonably wide tires and decided everybody should be riding, you know, 22s at 110 PSI. With, you know, 23 tooth cog, 3953 in the front. And so obviously the climb became unrideable. But now that we have like modern bikes, we've decided that it's okay to not pedal at 45 RPM up a hill. Like we have low gears, we have fat, soft tires. This climb is now rideable again. And then today happened. And it was just, I think the men maybe even had it worse than the women. I think this was one of those situations where you are riding and the rain has just started, so all the goop, all the gunk, mud, all that stuff is kind of like in solution on the cobbles, and they're incredibly slippery. Because this was just bananas how slippery it was. And the women had trouble too, but the women had like a steadier rain that kind of washed that initial schmutz off. So it was mostly just wet stones and mud. But it was super slick. I have not seen it this slick either. And the fact that Jorgensen was able to ride it within a couple seconds, 7 seconds of Vanderpool, really kind of drills down how much of a classics rider he's become as part of this team.
You know, the fact that he went from finishing, second at Romandie last year and mm-hmm. winning Paris-Nice to then he's going over the Koppenberg second today.
And I think, honestly, I think it's good that the Koppenberg played a big role. Like, it's kind of been a launch pad. It's kind of been like it hasn't been really a launch pad for winning attacks so much as it's been a like launch pad for the finale of the race. Like, this is officially the end of the race. It's like La Redoute in Liège. And to have it so obviously be the deciding factor in the race is really good because it's such a landmark. Like, it's easily recognizable. Anybody can look at it, even I think on a TV where it's hard to get the full concept of the slope. You look at this silly road cut into this hill and you realize that just what a absurd thing this is to ride up. And that to me makes cycling a lot more accessible. The Paterberg and the Oude Quermont are obviously awesome, but a lot of that comes from the crowds you have kind of stacked up, especially over the Quermont with the beer tents, with the VIP areas, with the everything set up. You have the tunnel of noise. That's really cool too. But if you go and ride that on some Tuesday afternoon, like, you're not going to quite get that same vibe. Whereas you ride up the Koppenberg, you know you're riding up the Koppenberg.
It's one of the climbs that I have seen that really, I look at it and I think, I don't think I could do that.
Have you tried?
I think, well, no, first of all, no. But second of all, watching today, I think I'm walking from like not very far up, right? Like, it's so slick. It's so steep. It's double digits. It's, you know, there's fans everywhere. The pressure is high. And then, and if you're not in the very front, then you're behind a bunch of other people. I don't see how you're not walking up that. And I agree. I love that it played such a role. It's something that Quermont and Paterberg have become the go-to climbs, but the fact that the Koppenberg is there it makes it like so much harder to go into these other climbs, the other various sectors that come after it. And it's nice to see it kind of get its due in terms of impacting the race so vividly. And again, I don't know if I can think of a time recently where it has been so impactful. And so that was great today, even if it was also kind of like hard to watch at some points, these poor souls who, I should add, at the start of the day, I mean, there was bright sunshine for a bit today. It was actually really nice for some parts of today. And especially once we got to Oudenaarde, we'd left Antwerp, we got to Oudenaarde, the women's start was a little bit away and it was sunny. It was quite nice. And I just remember looking at the phone and thinking, wasn't it supposed to rain today? Like, this is nice. Like, what's with the forecast here? Mm. And then within half an hour, the clouds rolled in.
You did it. You jinxed it.
I must have.
You said, what is this nice weather?
Sorry, and Peloton.
The bike racing gods were like, Dane.
They frowned upon me. Well, they frowned upon the riders. The riders were the ones who suffered.
You faced almost no consequences from this.
I didn't face any consequences. Like, I went to the press room where it was dry, and then I put my jacket on, and then I had a hood on, so I was fine. Once we got to the finish line, so the riders coming across, I mean, I can't remember seeing riders that shellacked after a race. Roubaix, maybe. I mean, I've seen some of that at Roubaix, but it's, you know, I talked to Riley Sheehan afterward, and it was really great. I wish I'd gotten a photo of him while we were talking, because it was a really good mix on his face of cover. He was soaked, absolutely soaked, and he looked like he had been, I mean, doing what he'd been doing. He looked like he'd been going all out in the rain for hours and hours. There was mud, you know, it was very much a, vivid example of what you do as a bike racer. And his eyes were just like wide open, like somewhere between, you know, completely exhausted and buzzing from the race. And he was saying that I feel horrible. I think that was the words that he used. I feel horrible. I need a bowl of hot soup or something like that. He looked like he had just been put through the ringer, and more even than you usually see at a bike race, which is pretty common. And yet he had a smile on his face, and it was like he was really enjoying somehow. He was fine. And it was just the definition of like what it is to be a professional cyclist, is these people who take this perverse joy in suffering. And that's what he seemed to have done today. Cause he looked like he did feel horrible. And at the same time, he managed to find the joy in it. And I would think that was true of pretty much everyone out there. Because even Vanderpool said that he was, you know, cooked at some point. But he managed to win. All right. Let's talk about the battle for the podium, because Vanderpool won by more than a minute.
So that actually segues pretty well. Because the rest of the podium, depending on where you looked at the finale of the race, was completely different.
Totally.
Every single time.
Yes.
Right.
There were many, many regroupings. Mm. It seemed for quite some time that it was going to be the former winner Alberto Bedial and Dylan Teuns on the podium with Vanderpool. They were in a group together chasing Vanderpool till pretty late. And then they got caught. One of several regroupings. And it turned out that Luca Mozzato was your second place finisher. And a couple of things. First of all, that is a great ride relative to other rides so far for the Arkea B&B Hotel squad, which has not done much at the World Tour level. I think it is fair to say. I don't think I'm being overly mean by saying that. Good on Luca Mozzato. He had recently won the Berdana Coxide Classic ahead of Dylan Groenewegen. So he obviously can sprint. That is something that he has proven. But this is the Tour of Flanders. It's after 270K. And he did it on a day that you don't just oops your way into, yeah, into that. Good on him for pulling that off. He's a rider that I think Arkea has reason to be really optimistic about based on the last... most of the last like 8 months, he won Binche Chamais Binche last year, was quite good in a couple of other races. And I think, yeah, good on him for pulling that off. He also in that sprint I thought he looked really, put together in that sprint. It's the third place finisher that really maybe should generate the real discussion here.
Which third place finisher, right? Because the third person across the line was not the person awarded third at the end of the day. And
the third person across the line was very emotional about his podium, or his erstwhile podium. He seemed to be very excited that he had landed on the podium. And of course, that podium would have come if it had stood, you know, not that long after he had just landed on the podium at Milan-San Remo.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, talking about Michael Matthews, who at first glance did finish third in the race, but according to the results sheet finished 11th because he was relegated. He was on TV when you were watching the finale. He kind of was a little bit all over the road. If you're watching head on.
Yeah.
I think if you go back and watch the overhead, I don't think he was over the road, all over the road to a degree that was worthy of relegation, but the jury saw it differently. And that's kind of all she wrote. There's not really much of a like process here. If the jury decides,
there's no consistent jurisprudence, right?
Right. Which is relatively inconsistent in this sport. The jurisprudence, I mean, it's like kind of doesn't exist. There's, you know, this is not a so-and-so court versus a, you know, You have years and years of the jurisprudence being one way, you know, in a certain court. That's not how it works in cycling. The jury one day decides one thing, the next day they decide something else. What's your take? Should he have been relegated? Why not? What do you come away from this thinking?
I mean, I lean towards not in general. Like, I think if you have to ask, maybe it wasn't a relegatable thing. But I'd agree a lot with Matt Heyman, who's the team director for this, who was the team director for this race at Jayco Alula. And he was like, look, there are rules. Okay, I get it. But, you know, we need to enforce them consistently, and they're not enforced consistently. Like, this same thing you'd see in a dozen different races, and four or five of them, someone gets relegated. And it's like, it's so variable. There's no, it's not like the jury writes an opinion saying, this is why we decided to relegate this rider. It's not like the rules for the relegation are very specific in like, if someone does this, this should be the result. If someone does this, this should be the result. It's very wide open. And it's, you know, if the guy had something, if the race jurors had something too spicy for breakfast, like that could probably influence the play. It's not good, man.
It's the football move of cycling.
I mean, the football move at least has, I think there's like a page and a half definition.
Yeah, I mean, well, in the NFL the rules have changed. What a football and even move when they is. Hadn't. Yeah, there was sort of a sense of what that meant. And, the, and this is, you're right, this is
vague. Cycling makes no effort to define that. And it's, you know, again, like it looked bad from the front. It didn't look bad from the overhead. And for me, like, the front is such a, the camera lies, man. Everything's foreshortened. You see these waves in the barrier that like seem like it's so obviously going to be a pinch point. And then you look at from above and the barrier looks dead straight. And, you know, everybody's moving with, I mean, it looks like a bunch of space, but it's still like super like split second differences between riders. But yeah, if you had the same committee of people making the decision every time, it would be a little bit better than it is. And it's just, yeah, you don't even know what the race jury is looking at. We assume they can see the same things we see. Maybe they see something different. Nils Paulet, who ended up in third as a result of this relegation, definitely seemed upset about how the final meters went. I believe he's actually slamming his front wheel into the ground as he crosses the line, which is something considering the wet road conditions. But yeah, I think this is just another example of how cycling needs a better system for this, because this is a big deal. It's a big point of the race. This happens all the time, right? This is a big part of racing. If we're going to have people who aren't contesting the race deciding the outcome of races, we need to be better about how we do it.
Yeah, I agree completely. I wonder if, I mean, this is going to open a can of worms, but like, is Paulet selling it there? And if so, is that part of it?
I don't know. You know? That could be. Like, yeah. I don't really know what I saw in the sprint, but I saw Paulet banging his wheel across the line. So something must have gone wrong.
Yeah. Last talking point from the Vanderpool dominated Tour of Flanders is that Yves Lampaert was Sudal Quickstep's top finisher in 18th. I don't really know what to say anymore, but I think it's worth pointing it out because it's a real change.
We saw Alaphilippe did some stuff. Kasper Askren tried to do some stuff. But yeah, I mean, clearly the team is not performing at the level they need to perform at. Maybe it's the distance. Maybe it's the intensity of the race. This was a pretty quick Flanders. Like, this was just, 6:05?
Very quick Flanders.
Like, I think the race was scheduled to finish a half an hour later than it finished or something like that. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, you're right.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know what to say. Like you said, this is a team that should be performing better. These are riders that should perform better. I agree. You know, Alaphilippe, especially kind of getting towards the golden years of his career. But like, there are plenty of dudes in their prime just not performing. And
yeah, I mean, Alaphilippe's not even Alaphilippe isn't that old.
So what, 34 or something?
He's 31.
31.
Yeah, Alaphilippe is 31 years old.
I don't know
old.
What's going on. You know, we need to split up Visma and Lisa Bike. And they just split the team in half and then get all these riders who should be doing better onto one of those teams. And that way they'll compete against each other. So it'd be more competitive, but you'll also have the performance improvements that we've seen Jorgensen benefit from spread out over more riders. Cause he is like, this is the best team I've ever been on. Yes, we don't have Van Aert. We're still the best team in the world. Like I think we are getting a real world picture of what happens at a well-managed team versus what's happening currently at Quickstep.
I really love that you just used the break up the Yankees argument for Visma Lisa Bike. And
I mean, look, Lisa Bike wants people to say Lisa Bike. This is the way to do it. It's way easier than running a social media campaign.
Sponsor two different teams because you were a monopoly that got turned into a bunch of baby bells. Yeah, I think you're not wrong. Be a good strategy. All right, before we get into what's ahead, there was a whole nother bike race. And you have brought it up. You mentioned the women's race in the Koppenberg. But we got to talk about the headline. What's the headline of the women's race? Because I think this is a big headline.
Yeah. I'd say Lidl Trek is the new Estee Works Pro Time. I think
that's even bolder than I thought.
That's what's happening here. No, I think the conditions were, while the Koppenberg may have been somewhat less slippery, conditions were even more brutal for the women. I think they looked as wrecked, if not more so, than the men after the line. Demi Vollering's post-race interview, I was like, she's got great English, very eloquent, and was just almost like looping around. You could see just the crackedness. Like I have felt that way many a time, and they do not pay me to race bikes. It was a real beater of a day, but great racing, great tactics. Everyone flat out. It was cool to see.
And it was Elisa Logo Borghini who took the win.
Yes.
What was it, 9 years after she won for the first time? So it was a second win. Mm-hmm. Took a win where she was one of the many people who was another favorite behind the very heavy favorite that was Lada Kopecky, who got left behind as she was one of the several big names who did crash, but did not manage to catch up to a lead group that included Elisa Longo Borghini, who finished on the podium with another Trek rider, by the way. So, yeah, new SD Works. I think Abby will have plenty more on the women's race this week on Wheel Talk. So, within 24 hours of the How the Race Was Won pod going up, you'll have all the analysis you need of the women's race as well. Check that out and get more of the conversation. All right, that's Tour of Flanders. That's how it was won. That's how Mathieu van der Poel crushed everybody. And of course, the classics aren't over because there's another big one coming up.
There's a lot more big ones coming up.
But first, let's quickly get out of classics mode just for a hot second before we close the show. There's a whole nother race. There's a whole nother kind of race going on in the Basque Country this week. By the time you're listening to this podcast, it will have started already. The Itzulia Basque Country is set to get underway on Monday, and it is going to feature Jonas Vingegaard, Remco Evenepoel, and Primoz Roglic, three of the four GC types that I think are sitting at the top of the hierarchy at the moment. And a bunch of others too. Carlos Rodriguez, Juan Ayuso, Brandon McNulty. Lots of big names going to be at this race. And it's going to be our first chance to see some of them facing each other. It's going to be a chance to see whether Primoz Roglic is really interested in actually contesting some races early in the season, or whether he's kind of going all in on a plan to take it a little more slowly. Yeah, but I'm excited to see Vingegaard go up against Evenepoel as well. And I'm excited to see Juan Ayuso leading the way for UAE. This is a race that Tadej Pogacar is skipping. So we're not going to see all four of the four GC types.
That'd be too much. Like having all four classics favorites at Roubaix. Yeah. Like, why would you ever do that? Why would you have all the good riders at one race?
I would take more than one. I would take two. That would be
acceptable.
It's true.
They're a little thin on the ground at the moment.
Yeah. But yeah, Tour the Basque Country. It's only a Basque Country. This week, over in the Basque Country in Spain, starts out with a TT. There are then five more stages, and they will be going over the very famous short but steep Basque climbs in Irun, in Vitoria Gasteiz, in Eibar. Yeah, should be a good one, and one that I hope will give us a sense of the pecking order, if you will. Although I will be shocked if the pecking order does not have Jonas Vingegaard at the top, given how well he has raced so far.
I want Roglic to win this by like 7 minutes. I want to just crush everybody.
That would be a great narrative, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'd be awesome.
Really tee us up for the coming weeks.
I don't. I'm not actually expecting that though.
I am not either. Yeah. Sepp Kuss also racing, by the way. After I greatly hyped him up ahead of Catalunya, he finished 13th there. So I will not do that here. I don't want to be the reason that he. Yeah. Maybe if I say nothing, he'll do better. We'll see. That's happening over the Basque Country. Stage racing. And of course, Paris-Roubaix is coming here in Classics Country. We do have Scale the Price in the middle of the week, but I don't know how much people really care about that. No offense to Scale the Price.
Sprinter's Classic.
Sprinters care about it.
The real Sprinter's Classic.
There are so many of them.
But like this is Milan the real
San Remo is the Sprinter's
Classic.
This
is the real one.
Okay. That's on Wednesday. Paris-Roubaix coming up this weekend. The women's and men's races on different days. Women's race on Saturday. Men's race on Sunday. The women will be racing to follow up a pretty spectacular showing last year by Allison Jackson. And the men will be racing to follow up a showing by one Mathieu van der Poel, who at the moment sure looks like a heavy favorite to defend his title. We'll have plenty more on that this week.
We'll see. It's flatter. Paris-Roubaix is flatter. And I think that will factor heavily into the racing. I think the hills were very much favorable to van der Poel against his current competition. I think he'll have a tougher time of it next week, but we'll see.
I think in general, one has a tougher time with everything at Roubaix. It's harder to be consistent there just because of the likelihood that you're going to crash or have a flat or both. We'll have plenty more this week here in Classics Country. We're heading down to Kortrijk, and we'll be at the race at Roubaix. And you can hear more from the various pods in the pod network here at Escape Collective if you just stay tuned over the next few days. So do that. And then Cosmo and I will be back in about a week, exactly a week even, to tell you how the next big race, well, races, because we'll talk a little bit about Basque Country too. We're one. Until then, I'm Dane Cash, and who are you? And what was this?
I'm Cosmo Catalano, and that's the How the Race Was Won podcast.